CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
Before we get started, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, it's brought to us from the New York Times. A panel says that the U.S. should weigh in cost in deciding essential health benefits, and this comes to us by Robert Pear. In Washington, the National Academy of Sciences said Thursday that the federal government should explicitly consider cost as a factor in deciding what health benefits must be provided by insurance plans under President Obama's health care overhaul, and it said the cost of any new benefits should be offset by savings elsewhere in the health care system. Moreover, it said in defining essential health benefits, the government should try to guarantee that the average premium would not exceed benchmarks that would be set by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. In a new report, the Academy's Institute of Medicine does not list specific services that should be covered. Rather, it tells the Secretary of Health and Human Services how to define the minimum benefits. That's a huge decision that could affect 68 million people, including individuals, families, and businesses that obtain coverage through new state-based insurance exchanges. Many other insurances will no doubt be guided by the government's decisions, just as private insurers now often follow Medicare's coverage decisions. And this is a quote, costs must be taken into account, the 18-member panel said. Unless we are able to balance the costs with the breadth of benefits, we may never achieve the health care coverage envisioned in the Affordable Care Act. If the benefits are not affordable, fewer individuals will buy insurance. And if health care spending continues to rise so rapidly, the benefits will begin to erode. By contrast, Medicare officials sometimes decide to cover new therapies without explicitly weighing the cost, and they've occasionally been blocked in court when they've tried to. The panel, headed by Dr. John R. Ball, former executive vice president of the American Society for Clinical Pathology, said the government should announce the initial package of essential benefits by May 1, 2012. That deadline may be difficult to meet. Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, said her agency would hold listening sessions where Americans from across the country could explain their priorities. The new 2010 health care law passed on party line votes in both houses of Congress said the scope of essential health benefits should be, in quotes, equal to the scope of benefits provided under a typical employer plan, end of quotes. The expert panel said the government should initially define typical employer plan as the type of coverage commonly provided by small employers, not by large or medium-sized businesses, which often provide more generous coverage. Moreover, it said, federal officials should determine what the national average premium of typical small employer plans will be in 2014 and ensure that the national average cost of the minimum benefits does not exceed that amount. This reading of the law was unexpected, but the panel said it was justified because small businesses will be among the main customers for policies in the state-based exchanges. And the recommendation is likely to please employers and insurance companies and could cause concern among some advocates for consumers and patients with particular illnesses who want more expensive benefits. In another recommendation that should shake up the healthcare industry, the report says the government should generally not require coverage of new treatments unless they show meaningful improvement in outcomes over current effective services. In the last two decades, states have adopted laws requiring insurers to cover specific services and treatments. The Institute of Medicine said such state-mandated benefits should not automatically be included in the federal list of essential benefits, but should be subject to review. And finally, in wrap-up, the new law lays out 10 general categories of essential health benefits, including some, like hospital care and prescription drugs, that are routinely covered by employer-sponsored insurance. But the Institute of Medicine said, it appears the typical employer plan will have to be expanded to provide some of the required benefits, like rehabilitative services and therapy for children with development disabilities. And thank you very much to the New York Times for our news intro. And the reason that we are talking about health and healthcare benefits is that today our guest, Ray Sneed, is joining us. He is the interim chief financial officer of Central Florida Health Alliance. In the last 2 years, Ray has served as a consultant at Akron General Medical Center and as interim chief financial officer at St. Vincent's Healthcare System and a partner with Tatum LLC. And for the 25 years prior to this, Ray was the owner of Medical Advisory, Inc., a healthcare-focused consulting company founded in North Carolina in 1985. Over the years, the company was involved in relational database software development, government cost reporting, temporary agency staffing, general business consulting, and a variety of other activities related to business development. Ray earned an MBA, Finance and Quantitative Methods at East Carolina University. He has an undergraduate degree at the University of Virginia, and that is in Commerce and Finance. And Ray is a candidate in an Executive Doctorate SCD program in Healthcare Administration with a scheduled completion in May 2013. Well, my goodness, Ray, that's an awful lot. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lorraine. It's great to be here.
Well, I have a first question, and this is somewhat of an unscheduled question. An executive doctorate SCD program. Explain to me, what is that? I've never even heard of it.
The executive, or the SCD, which is a doctorate of science, is not nearly as well known in the United States as it is in the European countries and in Canada. The difference between a doctor of science and the typical PhD is that PhD is designed to be a research or teaching degree, where a doctorate of science is an applied degree. And the mantra or focus of this particular program is the application of evidence-based techniques of management of healthcare organizations.
Fabulous. So you're keeping your hand very much in the keeping current through education.
Absolutely. I don't think anyone should ever stop reinventing themselves and ever relent from an effort to make themselves better.
Wonderful. Well, Ray, I've known you for several years, and I will say it's an absolute pleasure to have a dear friend on the radio show. I'd like to go back from a time when I didn't know you. Let's start at the beginning. What was your first job, whether it was a paper round? We've had one of our guests who sold frogs at the age of five to little children down the street, and we've had other people that have been gymnasts and so forth. Whether your job was paid or otherwise, what was your first job, and how did you get to being where you are today?
The first job that I had that paid me any more than you would get from mowing grass or doing newspaper delivery was my family was in the automobile business, and my dad started me in the shop on the grease rack, servicing automobiles with grease and dirt falling in my hair and face all day every day. And it taught me an appreciation for, first of all, hard physical work, but also the value of preparing yourself to do something different.
And hard graft and probably long hours and greasy circumstances, huh?
That is correct.
I hate to say it, but does that give an analogy for the CFO job?
You know, I think it does. I was talking to someone yesterday, and one of the skills of a CFO that's I think highly valued, especially in a healthcare organization, is the ability that I learned from that experience to. I can sit in the engineering department and tell hunting and fishing stories with the engineering folks, and then I can put on a tie and a suit and go in the boardroom and, work with some of the leaders of the community equal comfort in either circumstance.
So let me ask you then, Ray, you started with commerce and finance as your background, and your MBA is in quantitative methods and finance. What got you into the healthcare industry? Did you have a passion for that when you were growing up?
No, I didn't know anything about the healthcare industry except stay out of a hospital or away from it at any cost. I was recruited out of undergraduate school into the banking industry with a local bank in Virginia that has ultimately become a part of Wells Fargo. And after a number of years, about 6 years in the banking business, our local hospital decided to consolidate two hospitals, and they hired hospital affiliates, which was a upstart, fast-rising healthcare management company at the time, to do that consolidation and build a new hospital. And as a banker, I developed a relationship with the CFO of the hospital, who ultimately recruited me into the healthcare business.
So it was somebody else that, somewhat of a mentor, or somebody that guided you into it?
Yeah, I was very enamored with the healthcare business. It seemed to me to be a very exciting and dynamic environment. There was a lot of opportunity for applied finance. It seemed to me to be more entrepreneurial than a banking environment. And, of course, hospital affiliates at the time was growing very rapidly and providing virtually unlimited opportunity for good finance people.
So I guess a significant depth and breadth in healthcare that you've been able to gain. One of the aspects that is going to be a talking point throughout today's conversation with you is going to be that of you gaining depth and breadth. Yet you've had a variety of different roles, and you've been able to gain that experience by going into companies on what I would describe as an interim basis to be that chief financial officer. You've held a couple of other positions that have been executive positions. Let's talk a little bit about that, because you've had a very successful career as an interim CFO and in a broader aspect as an interim consultant. Talk to us a little bit about the role. What's the average life of perhaps an interim consulting project? Tell, if you would, the listeners as to what it is and how it comes about.
You know, Lorraine, to cite an old adage, if you've seen one interim project, you've seen one interim project. They are radically different depending on the circumstances. In my case, I have worked as a CFO or a CFO extender on projects ranging from 5 months to 13 months. The shortest project that I have experienced was a very narrowly focused project that only lasted about a month with some minor run-on responsibilities at the end of it. The project length is an unknown variable in every case. Typically, the client is motivated, especially at the beginning, to have the project run its course quickly because of cost considerations and organizational impact considerations, but invariably unknown factors emerge during the course of the engagement, and they get extended. For example, in my current situation, I was given an indication of 3 to 4 months, and less than a month into the project, the board of directors is contemplating putting a hold on a CEO search that the CFO, permanent CFO search, is dependent upon. And I saw my calendar being extended as that discussion was occurring.
Now, are you typically brought in by the board, or would it be the CEO? Who would bring you on board?
It's generally the CEO. When I've worked with a firm like Tatum, they have people in the field that are maintaining contact with a number of organizations, and typically the CEO is the decision maker because of the fact that this is an important position in the organization and because of the fact that it reports to the CEO. Generally, the CEO is the person that facilitates the engagement. In some cases, that we would describe as project work, and I would differentiate that from what we would call a seated interim CFO, where you're actually sitting in the CFO seat performing the CFO function. There's probably equal or greater work in the interim area where you actually become an extender to the CFO. And in a case like that, the CFO would make the decision and facilitate the engagement and would manage or supervise the interim CFO there.
Now, for the listeners that perhaps are not familiar, what you're describing is a situation where there is a CFO and the CFO extender spot that you're talking about, you're coming in to assist that CFO. With somebody as qualified as yourself, how does that work? Is that not awkward? Are you there as a mentor? Are you there as a guide? Perhaps are you there to be extra arms and legs? Why would that situation occur for somebody with such great experience as yourself?
I think all of those would apply. You know, first of all, you have to get your ego out of the way. It doesn't bother me particularly not to be the CFO, and there's a lot of people would say it's an advantage because you're not exposed to as much risk as you would be as a seated CFO, but I have been in situations where you were brought into the organization to bring a skill set that the organization did not have to, in one case, for example, to execute a large bank financing, and the expertise to do that was not present, and part of the charge on that particular engagement was to mentor a CFO who didn't have that level of experience. In another case where you are serving as an extender, as you probably know and has probably been discussed on your program, one of the largest challenges facing CFOs is just overwhelming demand. And there are a lot of things a CFO would like to do but cannot do, and they need in those cases to bring someone who has a roughly equivalent skill set. And some examples of a kind of a project that you might be engaged to work on would be and I'm working on one right now for the a transaction to sell a subsidiary of a healthcare organization. Another one might be a project that I'm involved in right now that would involve the development of a new hospital as part of a hospital system. A capital market finance transaction, kinds of things that require high-level CFO skills, but the day-to-day responsibilities are large enough that the sitting CFO just doesn't have the bandwidth to do it. And so it's not a competing situation. It's a situation where you're basically adding capacity to the seated CFO, and your objective in that role or in any role of the kind is to improve the probability of success of the CFO and also of the organization. So it doesn't bother me personally whether I'm the CFO or not. And if I'm not the CFO, actually it's a relief of sorts because I'm not being pulled in 100 different directions. One of the more frustrating things about being a CFO is being pulled in different directions and have competing priorities, and lack of ability to focus on important things is one of the most frustrating elements of being a CFO. So if I'm engaged to do a project, I can devote 100% of my effort and attention to that. I'm a lot more effective in that role, and the CFO is relieved of having to worry about this particular important project being accomplished.
Understand. And Ray, we've talked a little bit in that as to why an organization would choose to use some outside services. I guess the question that perhaps I might pose to you is it the duration of the project perhaps being short in nature being the reason that they don't go through an open recruitment? Because obviously there's going to be a somewhat of a higher cost of bringing in temporary resources than there would be to hiring somebody permanently.
Yeah, the way that an interim like myself adds value in that process, several facets to it. Number one, most organizations don't have the skill set necessary to fill those responsibilities. And if the position is left open, it exposes the organization to risk. It exposes it to loss of momentum on accomplishing its objectives and so forth. But where I think the value is really added is as a interim CFO, I can facilitate the process and improve the probability of the success of the candidate. The way that we do that is by performing an assessment in the organization that will help us to more carefully define the skills, the experience, the communication style, the character of an individual that would be successful in this particular environment with its unique requirements. Once we have done that, we feed that information to the recruiters and to the senior management team so that as they are recruiting, they have a better opportunity to identify, they have a benchmark to measure candidates against. Once a candidate is employed and comes into the organization, then we can facilitate by onboarding. They're coming into an organization with a mentor to assist in the transition and to be there in a support role until they're comfortable, and then the interim will step back and move on to the next project.
So in that regard, would you be brought on, Ray, perhaps as an interim CFO and helping in that selection, recruitment process and mentoring that once that permanent chief financial officer is found, there's perhaps what I might describe as an overlap onboarding process, I think you described it, and then at some point you will exit and that new person will be retained?
Correct.
So you've described not all interim projects are interim CFO. You've got to leave the ego at the door. How was it the first time that you got into that interim project? Is there a difference between an interim assignment versus a permanent assignment other than maybe its temporary nature?
Yeah, it is. I would say that the intensity of interim work is far higher than most people would realize. And the thing that makes interim CFOs successful is the ability to assimilate in an organization very quickly. And as you well know, a hospital is a very complicated organization, both from an operational standpoint and particularly from a finance standpoint. And so the analogy we use is drinking from a fire hose for the first weeks of the engagement, trying to understand how the organization, while they're similar, everyone is different and unique in many respects. So having the ability to rapidly come up to speed, as it were, is a critical success factor in that process.
So would it be fair to say that the interim CFO or the interim project consultant, they probably need to have more years, they probably need to have more depth and breadth of experience, because what they're going into, it's very fast-paced, perhaps very challenging because of the nature of the transaction that is being involved or the circumstances of being brought in, and they need to be able to be ready on their feet and run.
If you were going to stereotype people that do this kind of work, first of all, it's a lifestyle choice. Living in a strange community for a long period of time, you're not like the typical consultant that's in and out for a day or two at a time. You go there and you stay until the project is done. And it's also the intensity that you mentioned is equally important.
So you're on the road traveling a lot.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to be willing to travel. You've got to be willing to almost set your personal life aside. It's difficult to maintain balance in that process. And most of the people that you see doing it are late career, probably in the last third or last fourth of their career. They're very highly experienced. They have been in a number of situations. They are the kind of people that really thrive on challenges, and not easily flustered by a fluid situation. And of course, the other aspect of this is adaptability. As well as a client attempts to describe the situation, you consistently find things much different than you expected, and you usually find them more challenging than you thought they would be.
So that is an element of risk that you're taking on any time you come to an engagement. You agree on perhaps what is described as your scope of work. You think you know the circumstances based on the people that you've spoken with. And then you get to the company, you sit in the seat, and you find that things are more challenging or there are some greater variables that you didn't know about.
Yes, and the organizations that are involved with placing interim CFOs, where they add a lot of value is in having people that are able to assess a situation in kind of a sales process, but really focus on an appropriate skill match, because interim CFOs do fail when there is not the cultural fit is not right, the skill set is overwhelmed by the demand of the situation. And so different situations require different kinds of personalities, different kinds of experience, and different kinds of skills. So, you know, even on an interim basis, it's very important to get that match as close as possible.
Do you think that there are some specific attributes that you need to have to be an interim CFO?
In terms of the technical skill, not really. You know, what happens is different people have different skills. For example, if we go out of the healthcare industry for a minute, an individual that works in small to medium-sized organizations may be perfect in those kinds of situations, but in a larger organization that has public equity out there, that requires a very highly specialized skill set to deal with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the various organizations that that you get involved with by having stock in the market. And so someone who has a skill set that kind of at a lower level of operations would be out of their element in a different environment. That doesn't mean that they're bad necessarily. It just indicates that the skill set has to be very carefully matched to the needs of the particular situation.
And would it be fair to say that you also need to have that balance of what I call strategic and tactical in the dirt? You need to be able to, from the strategic perspective, understand the higher level risks of what I would describe come with the project and come with the nature of being temporarily put into a situation. You've got to be able to understand, pick up on facts very quickly, and you at the same time have to be detail oriented, because if you miss one thing, when you're one small element, when you're in a project on a short-term basis, the whole direction of the finances potentially could change based on that one piece of data.
Oh, you're exactly right, and the you know, that alludes back again to the ability to assimilate rapidly in the organization. And there is the great risk is not what you are aware of, but missing things and being new into an organization and not knowing where all of the functions reside and where various risk areas are housed and how they're managed, that does lead to a tenuous situation. And you know, one of the things about interims, a lot of CFOs, especially from larger organizations, become more and more strategic in focus and more removed from day-to-day operations, and their technical skills kind of diminish as their strategic skills are building. These interim situations require someone that's willing to roll up their sleeves, as it were, and get into the thick of these various challenges that an organization faces. You can't stand back from it and kind of direct it. You've got to get yourself involved in it. And some folks that have been in a kind of a corporate environment or more of a strategic environment sometimes find it difficult to make that transition of actually having to get into the situation at a fairly low level of detail and manage it to a successful conclusion.
Well, Ray, have you seen any common themes across the organizations that you've served?
Yes, Lorraine, it's amazing as different as the projects are, and I have worked all over the country doing this kind of work. Two of the similarities that I see on a regular basis, and I think this is something that every organization needs to focus on. Almost every situation that leads to a challenge, and I won't say that it's a problem necessarily, because every situation you go into is not a train wreck or a problem of some kind. Sometimes it's just dealing with opportunities that are on the table. But if you have issues in an organization that are creating difficulty, you can almost in every case trace them the root cause to either governance or culture. If the governance of the organization is sound, if the people on the board understand their responsibilities and understand their roles and execute well, it creates a very solid and stable platform for the management team to operate on. If the governance is flawed, if the decision-making process in the governance is not optimal, then the organization is going to suffer, and it's extremely difficult for the management team to compensate for that. The other thing that we run into time and again is culture. Organizations, each one has a unique culture that arises as a part of its history, as a part of its leadership, as a part of the forces that are acting on it. And sometimes this culture becomes dysfunctional and is at the root of business problems that result in turnover and challenges and people like myself coming into a situation. And the culture of an organization is extremely difficult to change. People are pretty much who they are, and what you see in a dynamic situation that may be stressed is that the difficulty of changing the culture without changing some of the people is very frustrating in terms of trying to get rapid cycle change into an organization, because the culture becomes entrenched and it becomes very difficult to change. And you'll see cultural issues and governance issues in every organization, and the business problems are pretty easy by comparison to figure out. I think most competent CFOs can look at a business problem and understand what the issue is and what should be done. Getting it done is the challenge, and if it's hampered by culture or governance, it becomes very difficult.
Well, let me ask you then, Ray, in terms of the assignments that you come into, you've talked a lot about the people aspect, the cultural aspects. We've talked a little bit about some of the nature of the types of assignments that you have typically. But how does the typical interim assignment evolve? Is there a process that you go through that typically has key elements to it when you start an engagement and then go through and towards the ending?
In my mind, Lorraine, it kind of breaks into three phases, and the length of the phases is variable. But in the first phase, you're coming into the organization just as if you were a new employee, and it is equally awkward. You don't know the people in the organization. You don't know how the leadership functions. You don't know where things are, as I have mentioned before. You don't know how certain functions are accomplished. You haven't really identified what the key issues are other than what you may have been told before you arrive. And so the analogy of drinking from a fire hose is appropriate, and it's just, you know, you're trying to absorb as much as you can, as fast as you can, because rapid assimilation to the organization is one of the keys, we believe, for success. And as you kind of get through that phase and start to understand the issues. And what I do in virtually every case is recommend that an assessment be done where I talk to, in this particular case, I've requested permission to talk to all the direct reports to the CEO, all the direct reports to the CFO, key board leadership, which in this case will include the executive committee and the finance committee of the board, and then also key medical staff leadership. And as you talk to these people, a picture will begin to emerge as to their perception of where the organization is and where it needs to go and what are the issues that the organization needs to deal with, which gives you really a strong grounding of where you are and how you need to apply your focus. The second phase is not much different than the life of a typical CFO. It's the day-to-day things. It's working on the projects. It's dealing with the issues that the organization is facing, whether it be a bond financing, an acquisition, a disposition, financial reporting, decision support, all of the skills that a typical CFO applies. And then you're also supporting the recruiting process. And then in the third phase, it's the exit, the transition out, when your replacement is there and you're going through the process of disengaging and helping the new CFO get started. And they're probably each phase is equally difficult. It is difficult as an interim to turn the keys over, as it were, and walk out, because you invest a lot of yourself into the project during its life. You develop affinity with the organization and with people in the organization. And I have found that even having gone through this process multiple times, giving it to somebody else and walking away from it is equally difficult. But those are kind of the three major phases that we see during the course of one of these projects.
And I would imagine at any phase of those, you need to make sure that you don't drop the balls that are in the air, because at any one of those phases, things can perhaps be let slip.
That is correct, and it's a continuing challenge to stay on top of. There's always multiple simultaneous initiatives, competing priorities, and usually the situation that creates the need for an interim is some related to some kind of problem or concern in the organization, and you have to address that. You know, in some cases, I've worked in a situation where there was a lack of the CFO, who was technically very competent, had produced multiple years of audits with no adjustments and no management letter comments from a technical standpoint, about as flawless as you can get. But the communication style kind of got out of sync with the board of directors, and there was a loss of confidence in spite of the fact that technically the financial statements were excellent. And so in that case, you spend a lot of time and effort restoring confidence at the board level. And so you never know what you're going to get yourself into, and that's why doing this interim work is you have to expect the unexpected and to be able to rapidly respond to challenges that you didn't expect when you started the job.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit, Ray, switching onto your experiences in healthcare. Our news article was about some of the recent changes that are taking place in the healthcare industry in the U.S. What do you see as the biggest challenges in healthcare finance in this environment?
You know, your introductory news article was illustrative of the kind of overwhelming amount of discussion that's now taking place in our society about healthcare, and I don't think there's anyone that does not agree that the nominal expenditure is unsustainable, the proportion of gross domestic product is unsustainable, the growth rate of healthcare expenditure is unsustainable, and as an industry and as a society, we've got to figure out what do we want in healthcare, and how are we going to pay for it? How that translates to the office of the sitting CFO, the things that I worry about as I'm fiduciarily responsible for an organization is to figure out how to do more with less would be number one. The U.S. healthcare system is relatively unique in the world in that the administrative cost that we have is among the highest of any healthcare system in the world. And so clearly there's a lot of pressure to reduce the administrative cost. A lot of that administrative cost is in the finance area and the people that process the bills, collect the money, and do all of the compliance stuff. We're not going to be able to have people like we have had in the past doing that kind of work. There will be an unrelenting demand to do more with less. Another huge concern is capital allocation. When the government was paying hospitals for whatever they did, regardless of the consequences, if you made mistakes in capital allocation, it really didn't matter because you would recover from it. Now, if you make a significant capital allocation decision, for example, building a new hospital, and that decision doesn't work out well, you're not going to be able to replace that capital through operating income. And in this economy, hospitals are seeing a reduction of philanthropy. And so the risk of a capital allocation decision that does not turn out well is extreme because of lack of ability to replace capital in a healthcare organization once it's committed. And then the third thing, it's kind of related, is resource preservation. The rating agency's outlook on the healthcare industry is negative. The trends, financial performance trends in the healthcare industry are negative, and healthcare organizations need to preserve resources because that's where the financial strength comes from that the ratings rely on. And there's a continuous demand inside hospitals with equipment that is aging and equipment that is becoming obsolescent. There's never enough money to buy everything that people think is needed, and preserving and balancing the commitment of capital to support the clinical mission and preservation of enough resource to allow you to maintain access to the capital markets what I would call the third major challenge.
And all in a time frame where right now we have an extremely high cost of capital of borrowing that capital.
Yes, we do. I was talking to some of the industry's best known financial advisors recently, and they were telling us on a speculative project, if you could get it financed at all, you would be looking at 6 to 8%. And that's hard to believe when Treasury securities are at 1% or less. But people see a lot of risk in healthcare, and it's making the cost of capital, external capital, very high, and it's having the practical effect of reducing access in many cases.
That's very challenging. And do you think that we can overcome those kinds of challenges? Is the economy likely to have some settling to it? We hear some reports that CFOs think that there's a double dip about to happen. Some CFOs say, hey, we never really left the recession yet. And others say, well, no, I think the sky is getting a little rosier.
Well, you know, two things about the healthcare industry. One is that it's not really, at least from a demand side, is not particularly sensitive to the economic ebbs and flows. People generally do not choose to go and do business in a hospital, and so the incidence of demand is fairly stable regardless of what the economy is doing. And actually, the healthcare industry is seeing demand increasing because as people become older, they make more use of healthcare. If you look at the Centers for Disease Control measures healthcare utilization in the number of people that admit to a hospital out of a group of 1,000 per year. And as the age increases arithmetically, the utilization increases geometrically. People under 50 use hospitals at a rate of about 175 days per 1,000. Above 65, it goes to 1,200 days. So we're going to see a huge increase in demand regardless of what happens in the economy and regardless of what happens from the funding side. And the challenge that we all face, not only as hospitals but as a society, is at what level are we going to pay for that? Because the demand is clearly going to be there, and it's arriving at the same time that the funding is becoming increasingly constrained. And people typically don't think a whole lot about hospitals until they have a requirement to use them. You assume it's going to be there, kind of like the electrical company, but the public doesn't understand generally how they're funded, and few people realize how capital intensive a healthcare system can be.
I think those are all extremely valid comments and somewhat scary. I think you're absolutely right. Until we need a hospital, until the arm is broken, or until some kind of an illness occurs, and you're being sped to the hospital at quite a rate of knots, you really don't have a lot of time. There's, from a patient perspective, there's not a lot of assimilation either.
No, I still keep asking the marketing people that are spending money on billboards to identify the guy that woke up one day and said, I think I'll go to the emergency room today. Saw the hospital's name on the billboard, and so I think I'll just go to the ER today.
Yeah, not quite sure where the marketing dollars are paying off on that one, but hey, we'll leave that to the marketing folks. We're in finance,
exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Well, Ray, we're drawing somewhat to the end of the show, and it's always a great pleasure to learn a little bit of a unique element about our guests. Is there anything that you think people would find interesting or maybe unusual about you?
Well, you actually stole my secret when you read some of my background during the intro. I am in school at nearly the age of 60. I'm at the University of Alabama in this executive doctoral program, and people are fascinated and enamored by the fact that somebody as old as me would be going to school in the first place. But I have done some teaching at the undergraduate level in years gone by, and one of the reasons that I am pursuing this degree is if I reached a point where I'm not physically capable or just kind of tired of dealing with the intense demands of these jobs, maybe to do some teaching. We need young people selecting healthcare, and we need people that have experience in the healthcare industry to do some of that teaching. Being exposed again to some of the academics, there's a huge difference between people that have actually worked in these environments and people that are addressing it theoretically. So it's kind of unique. It's a small program, and not many people that I know that are doing this can find time while they're doing it to also go to school.
No, I would agree with you, and particularly when you're traveling and on the road a lot.
You're right.
You must have an understanding family at home, huh?
Well, I couldn't do this without an extremely supportive spouse. One of the other kind of interesting things about me is I tell people I'm like a turtle. I bring my house. I live in an RV. My wife travels with me. She is she doesn't travel with me 100% of the time, but having that support from that side, it makes it possible to focus intently and to be on site a lot to provide the services to the hospital during the course of an engagement.
I think that's really neat. It's kind of a something I didn't know about you, Ray. That's kind of, you're almost like one of the traveling Hollywood set. You've got your little stage set outside, and that's where you go do your change of clothes for the next stage set.
That's exactly right. We call it the on a project one time, we were having a meeting in my RV, actually in the parking lot of a hospital, and one of the folks in the meeting said this we should rename this the Mobile Command Center. So we bring the Mobile Command Center out on these sites and run it like a SWAT operation.
I think that's fabulous. Well, Ray, in wrapping up on the show, we have a tradition on the show to ask each of our guests their CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
You know, we've alluded to this during the course of this conversation several times, and this is a quote that was attributed first, I think, to Mark Twain and then subsequently to Ronald Reagan. But the quote is, and I'm probably paraphrasing, but it's not what you know that'll get you in trouble. It's what you're absolutely certain of that just isn't true. And the challenge of being a CFO in general, or especially an interim, is to not be distracted and to understand what is really there. And it's not the thing that you know that's going to get you. So many CFOs end up in transition, not because of what they knew, but because of something that surprised them and surprised the organization, when in hindsight, the Monday morning quarterback said, you know, how could they have missed that? So, you know, my tip is I torture myself probably to a fault in on a daily basis of looking at every situation, not for what is there, but what is not there, or what in this picture is not correct. Because I think the challenge to doing this successfully is catching those things, and it's really more of an art than a skill.
Absolutely, and that is a fabulous tip, Ray. I think if all of us were to carry that around, we'd have fewer surprises in life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to Ray Sneed, our guest today, for sharing his innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thanks also go to our contributor, The New York Times, for the news article. And thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, who provides interim CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. And last but not least, thanks to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, or know another that might be interested, please contact us via the web and let us know. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.